Well, good evening, and you're very welcome along to our Life and Times programme here in Midlands 103. It's Albert Fitzgerald joining me in the hot seat. Yes, indeed, the black leather seat, sitting across me, looking very relaxed indeed, is legendary musician Ben Dolan. You're very welcome.
Thanks very much.
I have to say legendary, because I've heard about you everywhere.
I know.
Even as far away as I saw you dancing in Croatia.
Well, I've been everywhere, I suppose, when you think about it.
Okay, I suppose the journey began for you way back up in Mullingar. Tell us about your mother and father, Ben.
Well, my mother was Ellen Dolan, and my father was Paddy Dolan.
How did they say? Were they same names?
And they fell in love before I arrived.
Right.
Which I suppose was lucky.
Yeah.
You know, there was eight of us in the family.
Are you the eldest?
No, I'm not. No. We have five fellas and three girls.
Okay.
So I'm third in line from the bottom.
From
not
the
from the top. No.
Okay.
You know.
And what was
it? There was Vincent, a brother of mine, Vincent.
Yes.
Was next to me, and then Joe.
Right.
Joe was the scrapings of the pot.
He was the youngest.
As we used to say, yeah.
Who was your dad again? What was his name?
Paddy Dolan.
Paddy, and what did he do?
Patrick Dolan. Well, he did various jobs, but I mean, I suppose originally he was farming.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got married, there was a good few in his house.
Yes.
So he moved out, and at one stage he opened a bicycle shop in Austin Friars Street in Mullingar.
Okay.
When, I suppose, before the cars.
Because everybody had a good bicycle.
Well, everybody needed a bicycle. It was
right.
Probably their only way of travelling. Mm. I reckon that's how my father met my mother.
Did he ever tell you where he lived?
3 miles apart.
Did he tell you where he met her?
Well, as Balmain used to say, he met her in the snow, but she drifted, you know. No, in actual fact, I suppose she met him. Like, Port Lomond was his home place down, it's outside Mullingar, down on the shores of Loch Oole. Yeah, down on the shores. Now, well, we'd say the Longford Road, not that side of Loch Oole, the other side, you know.
Okay.
And she was from Welchestown. So I suppose he had to pass her house going to it. But I mean, she told me one time that she was down at the lake and she saw him and she reckoned that was the man for her.
Just like that.
Whether she was telling me a yarn or not, I couldn't tell you now. They're long dead anyway, both of them.
Tell me about your mam then. What was she like?
Well, my mam was, I suppose she was an ordinary woman. She was a milkmaid at one stage.
Right.
They had their cows and that type of thing, and she used to sell the milk from a milk car. They used to go around town and
in terms of the milkmaid was a great woman to land.
Oh, well, let's say she was or she wasn't, you know.
Right. No, like, I remember reading about that the milkmaids were they were well sought after.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose she probably got married young enough, like maybe 18, 19, 20, something around that. I wouldn't be 100% sure. Well, straight off, of course, I have her birth certificate at home.
Right.
You know, but she was married in 1920. It is a while back.
There was eight of you in the house, though, Ben.
There was eight of us in our house, yeah.
That's a big
And there was eight in my father's house. And there probably was eight in my mother's house.
Wow.
You know, in Brennan's. She was a Brennan from Welchestown.
Yeah.
So I'd say that, like, it seemed to be the good number at that time, you know.
Wow.
There was no,
what was the Dolan household like then with eight of you there? Must have been chaotic.
Well, I mean, they were spread out, like, I mean, I suppose over...
Like steps.
Well, nearly 20 years, the family would have been spread out, you know.
So a good few would have been probably gone from the nest.
Some of them would be out and working and then...
No, I know where you're coming from. There's seven in my family and there's 20 years between the youngest and the oldest as well. Yeah, so.
But you see, when I was... We'll say five or six. We'll say the sisters may have been working or getting out. But you don't, you kind of don't. Like, I always find if you talk to eight people that lived in the one house, you'd never believe they lived together because they all have a different story.
Yes.
It doesn't, like, the things that I found important probably weren't a bit important to Joe, or it's only when I'd be saying things, Joe wouldn't even remember them. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
What are your memories then of growing up in Mullingar?
I have a sister, Dimpna, the eldest, and Paddy would be 4 or 5 years younger than her. But Paddy remembers everything. And she thinks he's telling lies because she can't remember, even though she was 5 years older than him. You know?
What was life like growing up in Mullingar as a young fella?
Well, I suppose we were only going to school. We lived about a mile and a half outside Mullingar, so we used to walk to school.
Right.
So I suppose it was kind of the home life, and there was a good lot of people lived around us. And we all kicked football and played marbles and played cards and all the things that go with it. We were only a mile and a half from town.
Town itself, though, Mullingar was a wealthy town, wasn't it?
Well, I suppose, you know, well, we didn't have much of it, but I mean, we did know people that had money at the time, you know. Hmm. So our ambition was, you know, try to get it. If you can get it honest, all the better, but make sure you get it.
Right. And in terms then of you leaving school and so forth, what did you go doing?
I was a carpenter.
Right.
I went to serve my time as a carpenter. And I worked at it for a few years after finishing my time. Joe was a compositor. He was in the Westmead Examiner in Mullingar.
Putting the newsprint together for the newspaper.
Again, upside down, you know.
Yeah, and back to right or whatever.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So he finished his time.
So, but where did the music, was there music in the house when you were younger?
My mother was musical, you know.
In what way, Ben?
Well, she used to sing in the choir in Welchestown Chapel.
Right.
I mean, before I'm talking about now. Mm. But I mean, she would be always singing the songs. You know, she had favourite songs she'd sing.
Okay, but in terms then of music in the family, is it really just yourself and Joe went into the music scene? Or?
Well, you see, we have a first cousin there, Gavikins, you might have heard him, but I mean, he was a Cayley, you know, or Irish music.
Mm.
They went on to that. Frank Gavikin, who was the first cousin of mine. Now, Mick Foster knew him very well. He lived beside him, and I think he took a few lessons.
Hmm.
I don't know whether Frank took them from Mick or Mick took them from Frank.
Well, Mick had probably well to give him nowhere back in those days.
Between them it was.
Right.
You know, but I mean, Mick did very well out of whatever he learned.
And still going well.
Really,
still
really
strong.
Good, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Oh, fantastic. You know.
So where did then the music come between yourself and Joe, and how did it start? Or?
Well, I suppose we were always probably interested in music.
But sure, you played the saxophone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was I tried to play everything before I finally hit on the saxophone.
Why?
I don't know. We used to have, like, that cousin of mine used to go to the house and he had an accordion, mm-hmm. you know, and he'd play the accordion, and it really was something to look up to.
Right.
You know, a fella that could play. And then I suppose we were interested, and I suppose you were interested in listening to records, even though we said we didn't have a record player. But I mean, we'd say, like, when Rock Around the Clock came out, that movie, it nearly gave everyone a...
Yes, I was mad into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we used to all go dancing. But as well as that, like, in my early days, there was a brother of mine, Paddy. He was the caretaker of the county buildings in Mullingar, which is now the Arts Centre.
Yes.
Paddy worked there for years. But one of the perks of Paddy's thing was that he did the cloakroom in the county buildings.
For the dances.
Which meant that every show that was on, he would collect a bag of money. You know, even though money was small at the time.
Mm.
But I mean, that was one of the perks that he would do.
Mm.
So he had that. But then Paddy began to court. He got a girl, Caroline, that he married after, and he brought me in to kind of do the work while he was out dancing.
Right.
You know. And we got to the stage where we used to split the money.
Mm.
So I was working at the time for, I think, £1.50 a week. Now, that was after 4 years, served me time. I started with five shillings at the time.
Yes.
I mean, most of the people out there don't know what a shilling was, you know.
Mm.
It was a lot of money when you didn't have it.
When you didn't have it, yeah.
But anyway, that was, I went in. So every dance that was on, I heard every band that played in Mullingar.
Wow, okay.
Over, we'd say, 3 or 4 years. So, I mean, it really gave you a good taste. I mean, there was trumpet players, sax players, accordion players, fiddle players in every band, you know.
Right. But when did you, like, you were playing yourself and obviously Joe, singer.
This was really before we played.
Yes.
You know.
Okay.
But we used to be messing at home. We always had a bit of music of some sort at home, you know.
What was the first instrument then that you took up?
The first instrument I bought was an accordion.
An accordion.
Yeah.
Take after the cousin.
I used to be at it, and I used to be giving out. Joe was always at it, and I'd give out to him for touching it, you know, when I wasn't there.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
But anyways, it looked along. And then there was a fellow in Mullingar, Denny Hughes, was a saxophone player. Very, very good saxophone player. You know, he married a lady
from... fabulous instrument.
Married a lady from Tullamore, who only died not too long. Mrs. Hughes, only a couple of weeks. She was... what was her maiden name? I don't know, but I knew them.
Mm.
But anyway, Denny... I used to think Denny Hughes playing the saxophone was the job, you know. So I went to Denny one day and I said to him, you know, would you ever buy me a saxophone? And I had saved about £30 at this stage. And he says, the next time I'm in Dublin.
Right.
But anyway, he finally did buy a saxophone for me in Walton's for £35. And it was a white plastic sax. So, I mean, it was the dream. But like that, I mean, I went up to Denny a couple of days then to get a couple of lessons as to how to blow it and yes. what the whole thing meant.
Because there is a technique in it. There's a reed, isn't there?
And there's a reed in it, yeah. And I mean, yeah. well, I suppose the fella says practice makes perfect.
You practiced a lot then, did you?
Well, I practiced a lot. Yeah.
So where did the going you didn't come out of to go into a band or to
start
a band?
There was a couple of old bands round at the time.
Right.
You know, there was local bands and you might get a job to get one. Especially around Christmas, they'd all be busy. So you'd get a fella to ring and say, will you play with the band? And you go and...
But did you not play like in a town band or something, like a marching band or anything? You just went straight into it, did you?
No, I didn't play in a town band, no.
Okay.
No. And then...
You must have been handy at it then.
Well, I mean, I was amusing myself.
Right.
You know, my mother used to say, at that time I'd be playing in the kitchen, you know.
Mm.
And she'd say, go up in the room and play that thing. You're annoying the dog. The dog used to howl.
Well, obviously you kept at it.
Pardon?
You kept at it.
I kept at it. And then it went on that we were with a few bands. And we decided we went to play at a wedding one time. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the job, but another fella called Eddie D had the job. Some neighbour of his was getting married. We went to play at it. Joe, myself, and Eddie Deehy and Tom Riley. And there was a few local fellas.
Mm.
So we went out and played, and they said we were fantastic. The wedding people.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how drunk they were at the time, but we thought, because they said it, we thought it.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But anyway, shortly after that, we decided, Joe and myself, we decided we'd start a band, you know. And
what age were you?
Oh, at that time I was about 23.
Okay.
You know, and Joe was, like, I mean, I was old enough to.
But you were starting your own band. Like, usually it was some guy started the band and ran the band and the others worked for him or whatever. But you took control of your own band from day one.
Well, the snag was, like, there was a few bands around, but I mean, there was no work. You know what I mean? Like, the bands that were around, they weren't good enough to get a good job, but we'd say they'd get parties and they'd get fellas going away and maybe an odd wedding, just kind of very low. But they'd only have one one fellow we were playing with, he used to write to us when he'd have a date. When you say, when are we out again? He'd say, I'll drop you a line. Do you know, there were few and far between.
Right.
You know, so you had plenty of time to practice.
But when you started your band then, it was probably just a part-time thing, was it?
Oh, yeah, we were working.
You were still working away.
Yeah, Joe was working, I was working.
Right.
And all the fellas in the band were working at the time. And we did it. And the first date I got was, I was down in Rosemont. The ballroom was built at that time, very early on, and I had bought a minibus for bringing some of the bands that I was playing with round, and I was getting whatever it was, tuppence a mile or a shilling
a mile.
So
there was a bit of a businessman in you,
wasn't
there?
Well, it was only whatever was.
Well, there must have been if you had to go off and buy the van, so
you'd move along. Well,
right.
we bought the van. I mean, I saved up for this van, and I had £200 saved. And I used to go to Dublin on a Saturday and meet a relation of mine, and we used to go around the garages to see could we find a van or a minibus for £200.
Yes.
So, now it was a good lot, like 800 would buy a new one.
Yes.
So like 200 was a good lot of money.
Yeah.
So I used to go with your man, but one day I came home, and because we were out in where we were living, all the neighbours, not the neighbours, but fellas that liked music used to call in, fellas that had an instrument. You know, Seamus. I mean, there was loads of lads around had an instrument, and they used to call in. We used to call it a session, you know, in the house. But there was no one in the house only Joe and myself. My mother had died at this stage, and I used to lift up the piano, and I put the money, the £200, rather than for safekeeping, into the piano, and then next Saturday I'd go to Dublin. But there was once I put the money in and I missed about 2 weeks or 3 weeks by going to Dublin. And when I went to get the money, it all fell out like confetti on the ground.
Right.
And I thought Joe was out there cutting it with a scissors, because it was by being doubled over, there was this edge where it was doubled over.
Yes.
It was all chawed away down.
It's all the hammers.
It all fell apart. But anyway, when I picked it all up, I discovered the halves didn't match. Do you know what I mean? Like they were, they had half eaten.
Yes.
And at the time, there was, I think, about 80 pounds was eaten into confetti.
By mice, was
by
it?
By mice, a mouse in the beyond.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, when we found out...
80 pounds.
80 pounds. No, I mean, anyone could have come in and lifted it and taken the money. There was no great secret.
Was the mouse caught?
But anyway, we trapped the mouse. Joe and myself sat in the house at the range, and we put the piano was in the kitchen, and we put the lifted up the lid of the piano, and we set a mousetrap on it, and we sat back at the fire facing the piano with the fire at our back. So we watched it, and after I suppose a half an hour, this mouse came out, and I tell you, we were as nervous as if it was a lion arriving in the kitchen. You wouldn't believe it. Well, and he trotted up and down a few times, and of course the next thing he went to pick the bit of cheese off the trap, and it
End of story.
You know. Speaking, I nearly felt bad. But, I mean, the fact that we set it up and saw it happening.
If he ate 80 pounds, it'd want to be bloody
well,
bad.
Well, yeah, but I mean, at the time, you'd nearly, I don't know, maybe we were a bit soft at the time, Joe and myself. Yeah.
We need to take a commercial break. It's Life and Times, it's Midlands 103. And this evening's programme, our conversation with Ben Dolan. We'll be right back. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times, it's Midlands 103, and it's Ben Dolan. So you caught the mouse.
We caught the mouse.
Was that the end of it?
Well, that wasn't really the end of it, no, because I was, at the time, I was at the carpentry and I was doing a job in a shop in Mullingar.
Yeah.
It was Ambrose Welch's paper, you know, the news agent in Mullingar. But when I went in the next day, I was telling Mrs. Welch, who was there, and she used to write little articles for the paper at that end.
Right.
And it seems she wrote it. She wrote, she thought it was a great story about catching the mouse and everything else. But anyway, she put it in the paper. And I had a brother, Vincent, in Canada at the time, and he sent me a paper from Canada. And the heading of the paper was, Mouse in Piano Strikes Wrong Note.
And it travelled to Canada.
It travelled all over
how
the
many
world.
Papers did it get into?
Pardon?
How many
papers? Well, I can't remember now. I mean, that was 1959.
So you were famous then.
We were almost famous.
After you caught the mouse, right, and you got over your 80 pound gone missing, what happened next? How did you progress things?
Well, I went to the bank with the money and I had to wait for whatever 12 months before nobody claimed it, and then I got the money back.
Oh, you
because
grand.
I had half of the notes.
Yes, you did serial numbers.
I got that back, but we still bought. We still, I don't know, we accumulated another few pounds, and we still bought a minibus.
Mm.
And
what kind of minibus was it? Was it a Comer or something?
No, it was a Volkswagen.
A Volkswagen.
Yeah, or Croc.
Yeah.
But anyway, we definitely was. But I used to bring, at that stage then, I used to bring loads to Moat, to the, what was it? The Roseland.
Yes.
Was only built, just brand new at the time. And I used to build, but one night, I used to get, I don't know, half a crown ahead for the van. But I had about 15 in the van. In the minibus.
So you were chauffeuring them over.
I was in big business. And we were going to Moat, and at Horslip, whether you know it or not.
Yes.
Round the Bad Bends, I was going down, before just you go into
the little bend
the
there before,
now.
Yes. Yeah. There's traffic lights on it now. Yeah.
There was one fella called Paddy Doyle was with us.
Mm.
And just as we went round the yard, he says, pull up, Paddy Doyle fell out. And there was two doors closed in the middle on the actual minibus at that time.
Oh my God.
You know, the two doors used to be open that way and then the closed.
Yeah.
But anyway, of course, we had so many in, it was packed against the door. And Paddy must have was the nearest to the door, but he fell out. And of course, he just got up, brushed himself down. Now, we were probably doing, I don't know, maybe 10 miles an hour, 12 miles. But like, even if you stepped out in the road at 10 miles an hour, it's very fast.
If it happened these days, Paddy
would have the wagon. Now, maybe Paddy wouldn't, but another person probably would have. Anyway, pushed himself down anyway, and we went to the dance that night and danced through it and lived to tell the tale.
Fell out.
You know. But anyway, it went on from that then that we decided to start a band. And Joe went off on holiday to Galway for his holidays.
Mm.
And when he was working in the Westmead Examiner.
Yes.
And when he came back, he says to me, I'm going to buy a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, guitar? Where are you going to get the money? I says, how much have you? I haven't a loop, he says. He says, Joe's had a great time in Galway. He says, I saw a fella playing a guitar in a pub. He says, he was fantastic. I say, how are you going to buy the guitar? I don't know, he says. But
looking at you.
At that stage, without making the story too long, there was a fella, Kennedy fella in Mullingar,
right,
who came home from England, and he was on the boat, got jarred, had a guitar, and fell on top of it, and burst the back off the guitar.
Yes.
So I met him, and he was telling me about this, and he says to me, what did you give me for the guitar? I says, I'll probably give him £1 for the guitar. But I brought it in, being a carpenter, as the fella says, I was able to glue the back onto it, you know.
Yes.
I mean, it was of no addition. But I says to Joe, what do you do? He says, I'm going to bring you a guitar, I'll trade it in.
The cuteness of it. I love the cuteness of it.
But he wanted to do
I wouldn't buy your car off, you know. Go on.
He went to Dublin and arrived home with a brand new guitar.
Yes.
And a brand new amplifier. And I says, how did you get home? On the train. He says, the train. I says, where'd you get the money for the train? He says, I traded in your guitar. Your man gave me £1 for it. He says, and I bought a ticket for the train coming home. So that's where he got the money for the train, with the trade in. So he got the guitar and the amplifier. I remember it.
How did
it
you
was
pay
about
for
65
them?
Quid.
Wow,
he had no money.
Right.
And he got it in not in Walton's now, in, Tim was the fella's name. Well, it became Piggott McCullough's. It was Piggott.
Yes. Yeah,
time.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway, Tim gave him £1 for to get the train fare home and a free amplifier, a guitar. I don't mean free, to pay for it. Looking back, I can't ever remember how he paid for it.
Right.
Because I never remember him saying, I have no money to pay for the guitar.
He'd go off then and learn to play it.
He did, yeah.
Right.
Well, he got the guitar then, and of course he got the book. Now, he did piano. Joe did piano.
So he'd have picked it up quicker or whatever,
along with the lady, Molly Carroll. In Patrick Street.
Right.
That's really where the piano came in our house. My mother bought the piano because Joe was learning the piano.
Right.
You know, and I mean, he used to come home and she'd say, were you in for a lesson? I was. He'd swear a whole show apart.
We're having it at the moment, Joe. We're having it at the moment. It's the same as Joe. Our young fella's in the piano and we can't get him going into it all.
The next thing, my mother would meet Mrs. Carroll and my mother would say, you know, how's Joe getting on? And Mrs. Carroll would say, I didn't see Joe for the last 2 months. Well, my mother would come home and she'd be disgusted. Because, I mean, getting the few pounds to pay.
It was
dreadful, you know.
Yes.
And you go without your dinner.
Yes.
You know, just to get it.
My wife plays the piano and her grandfather used to send down a few quid every week. They couldn't afford it. It's an expensive bloody thing.
Oh, yeah.
We've our two young fellas, because my wife is a musician and she wants the lads to have music.
Yeah.
And you'd nearly want a 3x2 to bait him into sitting down in front of a piano to play it.
I know, yeah.
And it's such an opportunity. Yeah, like.
That's right.
What happened next then? Joe has the guitar.
Well, then Joe had the
guitar. You have the
saxophone. And we played with a couple of local bands. Like, that was really before we started the band.
Mm.
We played with a couple of bands and Joe had the guitar. And guitars were, you know, few and far between now.
In
the late 50s.
Right.
You know, electric ones. And I mean, the majority, like, people used to be advertising for a guitar player that time. And they used to advertise, no one finger merchants need apply. Now, you know, they didn't want you playing, they wanted you to play chords.
They didn't want you to play the three chord trick, like, or whatever.
They wanted you to play the chords, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, they didn't want you just playing the solos and that kind of thing.
Ah, right. Okay.
You know, even though, I mean, solo players become very popular as time went on, you know. I mean,
they wanted rhythm.
But at that time, like the first fella I saw playing the guitar was a lad in Athlone. Not in Athlone, but he played with a band in Mullingar. Now, he'd no amplifier at. But I mean, the audience nearly used to be laughing at him, you know, him strumming this, like, Barry was very close to a microphone, you wouldn't hear it.
Yes.
There was only one mic in the band, and the chances of him getting it were slim.
So you decided anyway to start your own band?
We decided to start the band.
How did you go about starting it?
Well, we just asked a couple of fellas what to play in the band.
Like who?
Like Eddie D, he was a drummer.
Right.
And Eddie says he would. And we had a fella called Sean Connolly in Mullingar was... he was an attendant up in St. Lomond's. And Sean was a trumpet player. They asked Sean says yeah, and there was a woman in Mullingar, Mrs. Fitzsimons, who was a piano player. Now, I mean, it was nice to have a piano player, but there was no pianos anywhere. And there was no electric keyboards.
And piano would be a heavy thing to be carrying around the back
the
of the Volkswagen.
I think we played with first day we played was in Castledown Gaegan, in St. Michael's Hall in Castledown Gaegan.
Yes.
And we went out. I mean, how I got the date, I was going to tell you a minute ago.
Sorry.
Because we were in Moat, down in Moat, at a dance. And I just happened to be sitting down. I don't know who was playing, but I just happened to be sitting down. I got chatting this girl beside me. And she told me she was at the ICA in Castletown Gagan, around that area. Mm. And they were going to have a dance, she says. You might come out to it. I says, do you want a band for us? You know. And it was the 10th. I had, she says, it's on the 10th of January, 1960, mm-hmm. was the date she had the dance. And I says, I have a band. We'd play at it. Mm. We'd no band. And this was... it was October or September, around late on, maybe a bit later. But anyway, I thought to myself, well, we have a date anyway.
That's a good start.
That was a good start. So we went and played. We played the date in Castletown Gaelic. Now, we hired amplification from a lad in Mullingar called, I mean, everyone will know him, Johnny Mullen, who was a very good friend and everything else. But amplification... mainly what he had was public address amplification.
The tannoy metal cognacs.
Right, yeah, it was for public address.
They're not made for music.
What? Pardon?
They're not made. No, they'd be very tinny, wouldn't they?
They were, yeah. But I mean, when you ask Johnny, I mean, Johnny was a real great character, dead now, pity's the thing, you know. But anyway, you'd say to Johnny, it's a bit sharp, Johnny. Mm. Johnny would say, no way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, that's bassy, oh. And then if you said, it's a bit bassy, Johnny, he'd go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2.
You know. So you played the gig in Castletown Gagan.
We played the gig in
Castletown Gagan. The 10th of January, 1960.
And of course, the lady that was...
What did you call yourselves that night?
Pardon?
What did you call yourselves that night?
We called ourselves the Drifters. We were, you see, fellas at the time, you know, if they weren't a player, you wanted to be part of the band.
Yeah.
You know, but I was thinking, if they weren't part of the band, like, if I was the band and they were the player, now I know it sounds nasty now, but one stage I had bought everything.
It was your business, and you were thinking about having different fellas as you need them and pulling them in.
Well, I didn't know how long anyone was going to stay with you.
Of course,
So I didn't want to be tied down either. But with the fellas, I mean, they were all really nice people and everything. But one fella in particular says, "I'll play with the band." He says, "You know, but I want to be a part owner of the band."
Right.
So I had bought stands and whole lot of things. Mm-hmm. You know, and he says, "Okay," I says, You can be an owner of the band, you know. I said, can you give me £150? I spent £300. Mm. And he says, I have nothing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't say any more. I mean, I didn't bring it up again. But it did wind up like that. Well, I call myself the leader of the band, but we did have the band between Joe and myself. Mm. Do you know, we were...
Well, I know there was a split, because I know the likes of Tommy Swarbrick and all those were playing, and then they went off and formed their own band after.
No, that was later. We didn't have them at that time.
Oh, yeah,
this
but,
is the very start.
But I know that was very common anyway, guys, to strike out on their own, and yeah.
It was, even though the time that happened, we were, well, almost co-op. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, in the band at that time. And there was still... well, we had musical differences.
But outside of that, though...
It was made up of pound notes.
Yeah, but I suppose at the same time, though, you had Joe.
No, well, we had Joe, but you see, like, Joe was only in the band. I mean, he was playing the guitar and he was singing the songs. Mm. The rest of the fellas, we'll say, were playing. The fellas playing his trumpet and the fellas playing the bass guitar. Mm. Like, everyone is playing away. And I know that... Everybody, but I mean, we did have like early on, before the band broke up, we had a discussion probably 2 years before, 3 years before, and we did decide to split up the money. Mm. You know? But then as time went, like I took a little bit more, and Joe took a little bit more. Mm. But as time went on,
that's business.
That's no good in talking about it now. It's under the bridge. You know?
So your first gig officially, I suppose, at this stage, then ICA Castletown gig in January 10th, 1960. You turned up with your tinny tannoy amplification. You got through the night. Was it a good night?
It was a great night.
How many were in the band that night?
There was five. We said the lady we brought to play the piano in Castletown gig, and there was no notes on it even. So I mean, that was kind of a waste. Of having someone playing the piano when there was no place you'd get, like, an odd place, you would get it.
Because the halls were very basic in those days, weren't they? They were only, like, used a couple of nights a week.
Yeah. But there was a priest down there at that time, you know. Like, we didn't get a return date for a long time, because the priest that was down there, Father McGahey was his name, and he had, Well, I suppose he had a thing about fellas and girls mixing.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
However, he thought we all got here. It's still a mystery to me.
That's a mystery to them as well. Look, we need to take another short commercial break. We're going to have a slightly extended programme anyway tonight. Ben is in good form here. We'll hang on to
you
for
a little
bit extra.
You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times.
So Ben, it's Ben Dolan. If we shoot from kind of 1960 up to 1964, it was kind of, my own research is that 1964 is when it really began to happen for the band, was it?
That's right, yeah.
And how did that manifest itself?
Well, we had changed, the personnel of the band had changed. Now, some of the lads wanted to keep their day jobs.
Yes.
Like, that's really what...
You were trying to make the commitment to walking away from being a carpenter, Joe going away from...
Yeah, well, it was easy. I mean...
Giving up the day jobs. Yeah.
I went professional very early. You know, I found that one night with the band was as good as a week's work. You know, no matter... Even when you'd have a bad night.
You probably had all the angles covered anyway. You probably had all the clothes bought and were renting them out. You'd hang on.
Well, I had all the bits and pieces, yeah.
I can imagine so. Yeah. But 64, you really went professional then, I suppose.
Maybe the end of 64. Tommy Swarbrick joined the band, and Joey Gilheeney. You know, I mean, they were professional musicians.
Yes,
like they weren't working. And I mean, Joe had finished his time, and he collected one full week's wages, and then he quit.
Yes,
you know. Now, I mean, I was always worried because the band business, like, to give up. Like, I mean, Joe's job was a very good job, still is a good job today. But mine was, you could be in or out. You know, the building boom you're in and the building boom you're out. Which has happened to so many people now. But anyway, where was I? I'm getting...
No, so we're just talking about in 64, you're going professional.
Well, that's right, yeah. Well, we took the lads. We took on, we'd say, Tommy Swarbrick and Joey Gilheeney. And these were, I mean, they were really good musicians, you know. Tommy Swarbrick was... He was a great, probably still is. I mean, he came through on the records he wrote. He was a good arranger.
It was proven over time. I mean, when he went on after that himself and his brother writing great songs, Eurovision. Lovely lyricist and melodies written by the brothers.
Tommy was only about 17 or 18 when he came to us. And Joey Gilheeney was around the same age. You know, so like when Tommy came, like even when he came to us, he used to be writing songs. Now, I mean, he'd be at the piano trying to pick out chords and that type of thing, you know. But he still had the gift of doing it. Now, I mean, the first record ever Joe recorded, he put a Tommy Swarbrick record at the back of it.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
I don't know whether it's "I'll Sit in Your Doorstep" was the name of it or whatever. But when we go to practice, we were practicing the Pops at the time, you know, I mean, pop band we were.
Yeah.
But we were practicing. And after the practice, Tommy would have this song and he'd sing it out to Joe, what it was. And like that, Joe would take an interest. And I mean, record it.
Tommy Swarbrick has told me that. He said that at the time, that they used to put him on the sides of the records and so forth.
He was a great out because there are loads of fellas to write songs, but they can never get them off the block.
Yes.
There's nobody there to
give him a push or take,
to sing them, you know what I mean?
So, 64 then, what was your first single?
The Answer to Everything.
Did well.
Did very well. It put us on the map. Like, I mean, we were, that time we were playing, like, we were playing maybe three or four nights a week, which was certainly enough to...
Who was managing the band on the business side of it?
Well, Seamus Casey came in at that time.
His son wrote the book on Joe, didn't he? Ronan.
Yeah, Seamus came in with us in about 1963. And how he came in was he was a school teacher, but he was a fan of the Melody Aces.
Who are they?
You wouldn't even know them.
Not so.
No. But anyway, they were a band that had been around the Clipper Carlton's time and after that. You know, they would have been out late 50s and that type of thing. But Seamus was a fan of theirs. And he knew the fellas in the band. Like, I suppose today, being a fan of a band, you begin to know fellas. But he went up north anyway for a few days where they were playing their dates. And when he came back, I said, just met him one day. And like, he used to run an odd dance along with me. If we had no dance on a Friday night, we'd book a hall and we'd run the dance and we'd make it 10 or out of it or 20 out of it, whatever. But you were working on it. We used to run in Eden Derry, upstairs in Eden Derry, a lot of the time, you know, when you'd have a free date. But Seamus went off and he came back and when I met him and I said, "Do you get any dates?" He says, "I got 100 dates." I said, you're cutting me. Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, we were getting, I'd imagine, £30 a night, mm-hmm. or maybe £40, mm-hmm. just up or down there, maybe 25. But we were in that kind of bracket money-wise. But Seamus came back, and I says to him, what sort of money? I said, you get? Well, he says, I got from £50 to £150. Jesus, say, I think it's time I got a manager. You know? So he says, so the next day we met in Broder's Hotel in Mullingar, which mm-hmm. is at the Green Bridge there in Mullingar.
Right.
And we went in and we sat down and we talked for 5 hours about it. And he was a school teacher.
Yes.
And we talked for 5 hours about what it was and came to an agreement what we were going to work on mm-hmm. for money or that type. And then shortly after that, Seamus gave up teaching and became full-time. And Seamus is still with us.
And was that the only job he had at the time to walk away from the school team to manage the Drifters?
He walked away from the school team to manage the band.
He did a good job then, didn't he?
He did. Oh, fantastic, yeah. No, he was a great manager because an awful lot of the people, we said, that took up management really were only booking agents. You know, they'd be in an office and a fella would ring them and they'd take the date, they'd write in and they reckon they were the manager.
Yeah.
But I mean, it wasn't like really where Seamus shone was he went down into the record business. Not into it, but I mean, looking for records for Joe to record.
Yes.
And that end of it and meeting people. Like, I mean, Seamus would be a good man to chat with. Like, I mean, he has facts and figures of all them years. Now, he was, like, I found that he was, and I mean, whatever he says, Joe would do, and whatever Joe would say, Seamus would do.
It was a good partnership.
So it was, yeah. And I was on the sideline.
Right.
You know, kind of thinking I was very important.
But outside of that, like, I mean, you know, in the 60s into the 70s, life was good. Young man, here you are. You know, the work is great.
Oh, yeah.
Bob, your own personal circumstances in terms of must have been changing as well. Like, I mean, you got married when?
I got married in 63.
Right.
Yeah, we had the band going and we were able to do it without going to work. You know what I mean?
Well, at the same time, it seems like he took a big jump of faith even to
That's right,
give up.
Yeah. And then and I had five in family, like.
Right.
I mean, from that on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now, the boys have a band now, Adrian and Ray. Well, they played with us in the band, Joe's band, Adrian and Raymond, two sons of mine.
Yes.
Now, they have a band at the moment. They played here in Tullamore last week down at one of the Christmas parties.
Yes.
Down at the Bridge House.
Do they have a tribute show as well? Is that which? Is that another?
I suppose when they started off, they were calling it a tribute show.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in a way, I mean, they're a fantastic band, if I could say it. Now, they call themselves the Dolan Band.
Hmm.
But they're a five-piece band. But they've a girl singing with them. She's absolutely...
She's supposed to be fantastic.
She's a stunner. I'm not kidding. You're really a great singer.
I've heard about her, but I haven't heard her.
You know, looks fantastic. Hmm. Great worker. Loves the game. She's from Dundalk, originally. But she's a... It wouldn't matter what you give her. She can sing it. As good as the recording was.
Ben, you kept your roots though, Ben, did you? I mean, at the end of the day, you were one of the more successful bands.
Well, I suppose when you put it down to 45 years, the duration was the longest.
But you were very successful, and you were making a few pounds. But you stayed in Mullingar. I know that Joe ended up living in Dublin, but yeah. You stayed in Mullingar.
I stayed in Mullingar and Joe stayed, but you've got to stay someplace, like, you know what I mean?
Right. Now, were you ever tempted to have moved out or gone?
No, I wasn't really, because, I mean, well, I think, I don't know, you probably know everybody in Mullingar. It's where you were born, where you lived. You know, now, we were all over the world. I mean, we played Russia, we played America, we were in Israel, we did all the continent.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like, if you name all the places, we were everywhere. Like, so, I mean, if you could turn around and say you got to live in London if you want to go to Israel. But, I mean, you didn't have to live in London.
You could live in Mullingar.
We lived in Mullingar.
Fair play.
You know, and most of the fellas that played with us always lived in Mullingar.
What are the highs of the career with the band?
Well, I don't know. I suppose the first few dates you get are the ones you remember best.
But does it become mediocre, or does it become, like... You know, you just said like 45 years, and even if you take 30 years of that, like you were a pretty hard-working band, to go up on the stage, same song, same routine, did that ever kind of get to you, or did you ever have to take a break from it? Or?
Well, the only thing, we didn't ever take a break. Like, even when the band broke up, we only were off the road for 3 weeks. you know, we put the new band together and then went back. The dates stood, except for three dates is all that was cancelled.
Right.
When we broke up, you know. But
When did that happen? That was back in the
That was 1968.
68, right, yeah. Okay.
In 68, like.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we had a small row on a Thursday night in Wexford. Friday night, I mean, I was disgusted because a couple of years before that, we had made a pact.
Yes, you were saying that two
that
or 3 years before that.
Was satisfied with the way things were, yeah, and we were going to stay like that. You know what I mean?
But I suppose if you've got driven people in a tight group like that, and you're driven.
I wouldn't blame anybody
now. You know, it happens, I suppose.
I wouldn't blame anybody now, you know. Because it really, at that time, I was nearly tired of the banyo. I was tired of the cribbing with fellas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd make a record, or you decide to do a record, and you say, what's this going to cost? Somebody say, well, a bit of advertising or something else, £2,000. Now, you'd always have two lads or three lads and say, I think that's a waste of money. And they nearly were wishing that it didn't click so as to prove they were right.
You were very fortunate in terms of the songs that you released. Though. You seem to have the ability to have a song for the right kind of time.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, no matter what anyone, I mean, everybody still know the facts of the whole thing, is that Joe was the facts. You know, the X Factor. He had it.
I saw it in my younger years. I worked I was a hotel manager, but before that, I used to work in bars and stuff. And one of the places I worked was the Blue Dragon down in Kilwert.
Yeah.
And you played down there.
That's right.
And I remember, like, just working behind the bar and you were playing that night. Joe arrived in for a sound check wearing this white fur coat or whatever he was at the time, looking out. But like, there was a buzz around the place before the band came.
Yeah.
The place was jammed on the night. Absolutely jammed. Sure. Yeah. You could hardly hear Joe singing, in fairness, because there were people singing all over. It opened my eyes at that time. Like, it was a huge experience back in. And he just, like, you were like, it was like the Beatles were coming into the
I know
place.
That. No, he did have. I mean, he did have it. But I mean, it's only when you play, you can play his records. You know, I mean, he probably recorded, I don't know, maybe 150 original songs. Hmm. I'm not talking about the covers.
Yeah.
He did loads of covers as well.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say there is anybody else, certainly in Ireland, that haven't recorded as many original songs.
Do you know something? You're talking about covers. One of my favourite albums is Joe 90s.
Joe 90s. Yeah, well, I mean, that's later on.
Yeah,
you know
I know,
I mean?
But it's just, ultimately, we're talking to Ben Dolan today. We need to take our final commercial break. It's Life and Times, it's Midlands 103, and we're chatting to Ben Dolan. We'll be right back. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times, it's Ben Dolan. Ben, before the break, we were talking, gosh, you casually threw off 45 years just of fun. And
Well, it was. It was fun, and probably was fun, you know. But I'd say maybe in the last, 25 years, we had the business kind of under control.
Yes.
So, I mean, you could get the bookings near enough wherever you wanted them.
Yes.
And we had a very good road crew, and we had good transport.
So you just had to turn up really and walk on stage.
We stayed in very good hotels, and, you know, ate well, and Everything was easy.
Did you do many gigs in that time? Like, was it like, would you be still gigging three or four nights a week, or
when we finished?
Yeah.
Yeah. No problem. You could have certainly did minimum of three, even after Joe being sick when he came back on the road. You know, we were doing two or three, you know what I mean? Okay. It's only now. I suppose when you look back at it, we kind of accepted that Joe got up and sang for 2 hours, you know. And I mean, the main thing was that everyone knew what they were doing, so there was no hanging about. There was no union meetings for what to be doing next.
It was
all just counted in. But like, if you nearly asked somebody to talk non-stop for 2 hours, they wouldn't be able to do it.
It was just second nature.
We kind of accepted it. It's only when I look back on it, how hard he worked, you know, like that.
Here you are with your brother that you grew up with, that you've known all your life, and you end up working all your life, your whole life. How was the relationship?
Oh, the relationship was great. You know, he always thought he was right and I knew he was wrong.
You got on great though.
We did get on well, yeah.
Like, he's known for his sense of humour. You enjoy a bit of a laugh yourself.
I do, yeah. I like a joke. Not today's comedy.
Right.
I have no time for it.
You like a yarn.
I can't see any fun in it unless you swear.
Yes.
Now, it's shocking that you have to. I was looking at the X Factor, and it was, a lassie came on there, and I was thinking to myself, she came on to sing with some of the contestants.
Yes.
And the first thing she done was she took her clothes off. And I just thought to myself, you know, long ago, they used to say, you know, if a woman was a good actress, she would never have to take her bra off.
Yes, yes. You
know? But I thought, this one is such a good singer. Why does she have to sing with no clothes on her?
Yes.
Or near enough no clothes?
Yes,
no.
Yes. And that's the way it seems to go now. It's the power of the video, I suppose, to promote the song. It's just like, and you can see it now with teenagers going around. Like, I was in Dublin last Saturday night. And we were in our own Temple Bar and stuff like that. And there were young ones in there, 15, 16, 17 years of age. It was a freezing cold night. We were the outfits going along with our warm coats, the whole lot. And they had literally nothing on them. They had no jackets, no coats. They had skirts on and they were shorter than my memory. And it was just, it's all the fashion thing because they see this on television, on the DVDs or whatever else.
Well, I don't mind.
Lady Gaga.
I like women.
We all do.
Scantily dressed.
Yes.
But I'm only thinking of a lassie going on the television.
Yes.
Do you know, like, I mean, if she was performing down in the York where there was 400 people looking at her, it wouldn't be too bad.
Mm.
But I mean, if there's 40 million, it's supposed to be. Like, why would she come out with a knickers and bra? You know.
Yeah. Did you ever get stage fright?
Me? Stage fright?
Yeah.
Well, I was always kind of nervous going on stage. But I mean, the things that worried me at the time, trivial now, you know, when I look back, you would be thinking, now, I mean, Joe never said how many was in it tonight. I always said how many was in it, do you know?
Yeah.
Or Joe never says how much do we get?
Yes.
And I always had to know how much we got, you know. So there were things that put
you didn't take
back,
it for granted.
Pardon?
You didn't take it for granted.
Well, I didn't enjoy it enough. Let's say it that way. That I could have. Now, probably in my mind, I had the responsibility of making sure the boys didn't get jarred.
Yes.
Making sure that
everybody got paid.
Making sure they got their dinner. Sure they get their wages.
Yeah.
You know what
I
mean?
Yeah.
Little things.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it was, looking back, it was a very simple job. But I mean, in my mind, it was a very important job, you know. But like that, I suppose every fella collected his wages. I never left a fella without his wages in the yoke. You know, like little things that I take credit for. But as far as the success of the whole thing, I mean, my input, you know, maybe we could have done 20 years and all wind up in the gutter. We could have blew every shilling we got, even though the taxman took it off me at the finish, you know. But anyway, it was a good job I had a bit under the bed.
Because you are a successful businessman even now. You mean you have your own businesses?
Ah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, you're you know, you didn't pick it up off the street like you're.
No, well, we have a nice recording studio in Mullingar. But I mean, there's no money, we'd say, for people recording. But we have a nightclub there. You know, Mojo's nightclub.
Yeah,
and does very, very well. And a son of mine looks after it. So all I have to do is kind of, Adrian looks after the other thing, and Ray does his bit. And I have Michael then is my farmer. And Sandra works in the bank in Mullingar there. So
looks after your money. You've covered every direction.
All I have to do is walk around and look important.
How would you describe yourself now, Benny? Are you retired, semi-retired, still working?
Well, I'm retired, sure. I mean, I'm retired from show business.
Right. Are you though? But you're still writing, you're still doing a bit of recording.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't count that, you know, like, I mean, if you're not getting paid for what you do, I wouldn't count it a job, you know.
Right. When did you find out, just for a moment if I may talk about it, when did you find out Joe was sick?
Well, Joe got a hip replacement. And like up until he got the hip replacement, he used to just be complaining just of a pain in my leg or a pain in my hip. You know, nothing to stop him. I mean, it's an awful sin for me to say, but if we were someplace and the boys had a good few jars the night before, I'd nearly blame it because he'd a couple of jars the night before. You know?
Yeah.
It's shocking. Yeah. Shocking to say. But, like, I mean, he loved a drink. He loved a bar. He loved people in a bar.
He loved the crack,
He loved that end of it, you know?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't that. He didn't drink that Not much, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He couldn't, because like at one stage, probably when we're doing the dances, fellas, because you'd go and you'd be in a place for a couple of hours, maybe you'd have a couple of drinks. I think it ruined all the bands, the fact that they got relief bands, because when you had to play from 9 to 2, it meant that when you put the gear up, you had to start working. But then all of a sudden they got a relief band that didn't have to go until 12 o'clock.
Right.
So you were in the place from 9 till 12, 3 hours.
Yeah.
And there was no... There wasn't any facility in the dance hall.
You couldn't go off and watch a DVD
or
whatever.
So you had to go somewhere where there was a war. And the chances are there was a pub.
Yeah, yeah.
And you went in and had a couple of drinks. Mm. Now, I know everybody, a couple of drinks does no harm to anybody. But then fellas think, well, I better have another one, you know. Another one. A bit like Jerry, poor old Jerry Ryan. You know, probably the first time he took a bit.
Yeah.
Was give him a great boost.
Yeah.
But then he needed an extra little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we... Well, none of them wound up alcoholics anyway.
Right.
You know, they were
but in terms of Joe getting
pleasant
sick,
drinkers.
Did Joe turn around to you and said, look, I'm in a bit of bother? Or?
No, he just says that the hip was bad. And he had, every doctor in the country was either at the show or he knew them and everything, you know. But anyway, he decided to get the hip done.
Mm.
It showed up on a
scan or whatever,
that he had a hip. So he got the hip done. And after he got the hip done, he was down in Kilkenny, in a little private hospital down there, I think, in Kilkenny.
That's where they do the hips, actually. They'll kill Crean or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, he got the hip done. And when I went down to him, he says, no, he was up 2 days after getting the hip done.
Hmm.
And of course, he was too proud to have a crutch, a walking stick. Like, probably little things like that. But it's kind of a trait in our family. You never tell anybody in the family how you're feeling.
Never better, yeah.
You're never better. I had a brother in England who died in the hospital. We didn't even know he was in hospital. But the day before he used to leave hospital, he got a clot, got a heart attack or whatever it was, and died. And of course, then we had to come and we were saying, geez, you never give us a ring, you know. But I mean, I have a sister that wouldn't ring either. A couple of sisters, like, we're all...
Yes.
You know, we're all going to live forever.
And,
all the Dolans.
Yeah,
you know? And like, if someone has something, you say, yeah, they don't know how he got that, you know.
So you went down to McLean.
But I went down and just... Joe says to me, Jesse, he says, there was a doctor here a minute ago, he says, and he told me I was a diabetic. So, now, there was never a word about that before, even before the operation.
Mm.
You know, like, why nobody said you're a diabetic? You know, but anyway... He honestly, like in my mind, he didn't really look after the diabetes after.
Mm.
You know, because we'd go playing, bless us, and he'd say to Dennis Mee, who was our roadie, well, more than a roadie, he was everything, Dennis, but he'd go to Dennis and he said, Jez, I'm about to forget my tablets. And Dennis would have to go down to a chemist, and they would ring probably Dr. Hansen down and
whatnot. Yeah.
He'd say, yeah, you can give them. And then he'd get the little things like that, you know. Or and then one stage, I says, like, really, if I says to him, you know, how are you feeling, you know? What are you, a fucking doctor? Like, but that's how, that's, I think that might have been the big thing.
Mm.
Because it's only now after. I mean, diabetes is an awful disease. Even though half the country can live their whole life with it.
Yeah.
But like if you don't follow the rules,
yes,
you know, it can do everything.
Hmm.
Crock your legs, your
eyesight, your everything.
I mean it's
But I know he was sick for a while and I know that he soldiered on. I know that the trooper that he was and
well then he came back after like when he came back on the road after the hip was done, after about whatever it was, 12 months, you know, we played round and I'm sure business was, I mean, it was booming, like, you know.
Right.
Like, it was just mentioned he was coming in the presence room.
Yes, it was
really, really good. But, and then, I mean, I suppose he had so many friends around the country. There's pockets of people that, well, I mean, I was talking to people that says their social life was finished when he died.
Hmm.
That was the end of it for them. There were people that just, they only picked the days that go out.
There was one, there was a friend of ours, and she was inconsolable.
Yeah.
Couldn't. In actual fact, the I remember there was, even on this radio station, there was a programme. And the programme was supposed to go out as sort of an hour, and it went on for hours because people were just...
Yeah.
And it was like listening to old friends sitting around talking about somebody.
That's right, yeah.
You know, Royce was here and, gosh, Frankie McDonald came on and everybody. Like,
I know, yeah.
How did you... I mean... How were you told, or how did you find out that he'd gone? Or?
Well, I mean, Joe was in hospital in Dublin, and I went up. I was there, man, I was up a couple of times, like, and he was, you know, he probably was gradually getting sicker. But I mean, he was only saying that what doctor is coming in tomorrow, and I'll have this thing right, you know, and I'll be out the day after tomorrow. Like, he was okay, and then it just came up to Christmas, and he says to me, I'm going out for Christmas. I says, what are you going out for? Well, he says, all the crowd that work here, he says, you know, the kind of, the more people that's out, it's the better. He was nearly thinking like that. He was making it
didn't
easy.
Want to be a burden.
Didn't want to be a burden. So he went home in Dublin. He lives out in Foxtrot. But he went home, and he rang me then on Christmas Day, the usual thing on Christmas Day, Happy Christmas. And we were all at home, and rang the sisters of them all around. That was about, we'd say, maybe 2 o'clock of the day on Christmas Day. And then at about 6 o'clock, he rang me and says, you know, I'm not feeling too well. He says, but I'm having a Dr. So-and-so's coming into me in the morning. And I was thinking, I'll go back into hospital, he says, and I'll get the job done early in the morning. So he was on his way back to hospital, he took a brain hemorrhage. Like the ambulance had to come round for him, you know. And on his way back, he took a brain hemorrhage, and then they rang us. That was on Stevens's Day.
Yes.
You know, but it was, he probably was dead on Christmas night, even though it went to Stevens's Day.
He had the machine,
but
yeah.
He had the brain hemorrhage. And then he was on a machine, like, when I went up, and, I mean, the doctors were there, and the nurses, and everyone was there, you know. And he was on that machine that keeps you alive. Well, as far as I see, it really keeps the air into you, you know. But I mean, he was, like, as far as his body was, he was roasting, you know, like, and everything else. And they talked about it. That was kind of the worst part, was when they switched it off. Well, they asked us, what would we do? And they explained that it was a brain hemorrhage, you know, that...
They'd have done all the tests,
could,
I suppose,
he,
to see if...
He stay on the machine, but that he was dead, they says, you know, medically, he was, so...
It's been tough.
They took the machine off, and then he... That was it.
You know. Mullingar has never seen a funeral like it before.
No.
Or since.
No, or since, yeah.
Huge.
No, it was a beauty. Well,
must have given you great comfort.
If you could say it was a beauty of a funeral.
But it was televised. I suppose it's only when things like that happen that you really see how people feel about somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, feelings ran deep, didn't they?
Oh, serious altogether. Yeah.
I mean,
it's still nearly the same in Mullingar, even though Joe's away at the moment.
The statue, rocking.
It seemed to get loose on the.
I suppose everybody wanted to get their photograph taken with it, leaning against it and all that. Of course, yeah.
So it was like, I mean, it's whatever it was there.
And it was a Mullingar company design. That was Genesis, wasn't
Genesis,
it?
Genesis, yeah. They had the contract of doing it. But then when that was being done, the initial part of it was done in England. You know, there was an artist in England
The mould or whatever.
Well, he did it off photograph. I mean, it's a great likeness.
Isn't it?
Now, like, you know.
And he's kind of just waving at you there, yeah.
It is a great likeness. But Adrian and myself went over to check when they were doing that a couple of times. Adrian's my eldest lad, you know. But we went over to England to do this, and out to your man that was doing it. And when we looked at it, we thought, you know, it wasn't, he was a bit cheeky or something. It wasn't right, we thought, anyway. And he wound up, your man gave us the scapular or whatever
the thing he used for carry.
It's in clay,
right?
The whole thing, you know. And he gave it, and both Adrian and myself, we scraped off a few little bits that we thought
to give him a facelift.
We're bulging out a little bit. Now that was the finish.
And there's a bridge and all named after him recently.
Yeah,
I mean, he's a good tourist attraction for Mullingar.
I'd say so. Yeah. No. I mean, we get loads nearly every day. There's people from all over the country. I think people just say is there someplace we can go?
Right.
And they just decide to go to Mullingar. Now, they go to the Bloomfield there. We get a lot of people and the gravel. you know, a lot of people come and stay for a couple of days in the Gravel or a stay.
Any plans to do anything further up? Like, I mean, gosh, surely there should be an annual Joe Dolan festival or something like that.
Loads of people talked about it. Do you know what I mean? But the only thing was, we'll say when the statue was erected, or around that time that we had Joe on the big screen in town and that, you know. Now, the whole thing, I mean, the council were fantastic to us, you know. Like, all the councillors, when you think of them all over Westmead, for to get a vote that they will do just this one job, you know, without anyone disagreeing, it was something to say they would put up the statue, or to say they would.
But even if you look, if you look back, Ben, at the amount of people physically who went to the gigs and saw him over 40 odd years.
That's right.
I mean, hundreds of thousands of people have seen him perform, were touched by the magic. Yourself, though, where are you now in your life?
Well, at the moment now, I decided to do a little bit of recording.
Right.
You know, I don't know what to say it's for, but I don't know whether I'll be a second time round.
This radio station will give it one spin at least anyway.
But a few songs. I wrote a couple of songs and we're putting it on it, and, you know, fun songs more than
you look good.
You know, while I'm...
You look fresh now, in fairness. You look relaxed and, you know, enjoying life and doing a bit of farming and...
Well, doing a bit of farming, just not much. I go out and look important. That's it, you know what I mean?
You have a great sense of humour anyway, so keep that.
We have good lads. I have a good family, I suppose, is that they kind of picked up where the whole thing left off.
They wouldn't be good unless they were taught it. So, you know, you're well done on that.
Thank you.
Ben, we're going to leave it there.
That's good.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come in. We've extended it a little bit. I could talk to you for another hour.
Ah, well, there's...
We might,
there's another book.
We leave the last few bars to Joe.
Ah, yes, indeed. Thanks very much.
Ben Dolan, thank you very much.
Goodbye, my lovely friend. Your bridge is signed over.